listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host for the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have an old friend, a returning guest, stand-up comedian and talk show host, Rajiv Satyal. How are you?
Doing great, Nikki. Thanks for having me back.
No worries. How's life? How have you been doing post-pandemic?
Things are good. Jumping right back into the mix. You know, this pandemic has been sort of start-stop, but I guess it's endemic now, so... Right. Academic, endemic, pandemic. I don't know what all is going on, but we're back in. We're ready to go.
Are you back doing stand-up? Are you doing mostly the talk show stuff? Tell me a little bit about what you're busy with.
Yeah, it's both. You know, stand-up has definitely been the thing that has kept me going through the pandemic and now. But getting season two of the talk show, What Do You Bring to the Table, out has been super exciting. I think we have two more episodes to go in season two, and then we're working on season three. And the show is really focused on showcasing South Asian talent. Eventually, we're supposed to make the pivot to East Asian, Latino, European, Jewish, Black, everybody. Just really kind of the immigrant story in America. So first, second, third awesome. Generation people here. But so far, we haven't been able to pivot away from brown people because there are just too many interesting ones so far.
Well, you know what? It's a timely point to do that. Tell me a little bit why you wanted to do that.
You know, it started in 2018 in the midst of the Donald Trump administration, and I felt that immigrants, minorities, people of color, whatever you want to call us, a friend of mine says, don't call us minorities, because if you take the global population, Chinese and Indians alone are 40%. I don't think we're right. minorities.
Right.
And I was like, that's a pretty good idea and pretty good concept. So I just think immigrants in America and children of immigrants, so on and so forth, we're really downtrodden, and I felt like we needed a counterbalance.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's like when Crazy Rich Asians came out, I was like, yes, this works for a reason. It's good for a reason. And you see people like Joe Coy also doing an all-Filipino cast for his movie. It's like we're long overdue for that kind of thing, for an East Indian, either a comedy or a movie that's not Slumdog Millionaire, that's like told in a story that kind of fantasizes some elements of India and doesn't really give you like the real essence of our culture, you know? So I love that you're putting a spotlight on this. And, you know, did you kind of feel when the Trump administration was doing their thing that you were fighting this uphill battle for East Indians or South Asians kind of wanting to be the voice? Or did you feel like it just needed a vehicle and a medium to kind of showcase talented folks that are, you know, from there?
Yeah, I think it is to normalize our representation in Western media, right? It's great to see, like you said, stories about people who are specifically Indian, specifically they see specifically South Asian, but it's kind of cool to see people who just happen to be that, where the race is incidental. And, right. you know, that's one lens through which we see the world. Certainly being Indian is a strong strand of my personality, of my character, of my dharam, of my whole being. But I'm more than that. I'm a short guy. I'm a bald guy. I'm an Ohioan. I'm somebody who grew up in Fairfield, Ohio, Cincinnati, you know. Right. I'm a Bengals fan and a Reds fan and all those things. And, you know, just because I'm Indian doesn't mean I see everything only through that lens. And so right. when you tell a story where it's like, oh, that could have been anybody, not maybe that entirely, because then you sort of feel like your race and ethnicity is disappearing entirely. And that's fine, too. But just so that it's there, maybe 20, 30% of it instead of 100% feels like progress to me.
I have to ask you, I thought about you during the Super Bowl when the Bengals and the Rams were playing. It's like, I know you're a diehard Bengals fan, but you have to have some love for LA. Who did you root for? Did you choose quarter by quarter who you were rooting for or what?
You know, I went to the game.
Oh my God, I didn't know this.
That was quite a story in and of itself. Valentine's Day was the next day, and my wife didn't know I was going to the game, so she saw red either way. She was getting red for Valentine's Day, or just the fact that it was a hangover from the fact that her husband didn't tell her, went to the game, spent quite a bit of money doing so. But I had a friend talk to me about it. He just goes, you know, my friend Akhil, you know, and he saved me a seat next to him and all this kind of stuff. He goes, I can't believe you're considering not going. You are Mr. Ohio to Cali. You are Mr. Cincinnati to Los Angeles. How are you not coming to this game? And I actually ended up going in the second quarter because I was so torn. It was really expensive. Should I do this? I don't know if we're going to win. I always had a feeling we were going to lose, although we lost in a terrible way. People always say that to me. Were you torn? Look, I'm a light Rams fan, which I think are most Rams fans. I don't think you have too many diehard fans here. Right.
Very true.
Although I am a fan of theirs. It's kind of like Ram. They have Ram in the title. I'm Hindu, so I kind of feel like I could be a Rams fan. That said, you know, being a Bengal Tiger, I guess, being, you know, that being kind of an all-Indian Super Bowl here, so to speak. But I was like, man, people are like, you win either way. I go, no, you lose either way. You never want your number one to meet your number two. You never want your wife to meet your girlfriend. Like, do you know anything about the way society set up? I'm all in on the Bengals, man. I had fallen off the bandwagon for a while when they sucked and blew so many games. And I felt like Boiler Room. I felt like the dad in Boiler Room. Clean up your life, and then we can have a relationship. When you guys win one playoff game, I'm back. And they did, and they won one, they won two, they won three.
I mean, they have a team. If they have a team, it's like they could be, you know, contenders almost every year, just depending. Just
knock on wood, brother. Yeah. I hope so. It was a great run. Super proud of those guys. But you know what? I'm happy for the Rams. It was great to be in a city that has seen championships, you know, in basketball, baseball, you know, football, all these things in L.A. And, hey, I'm an L.A. fan, so sure. If we had to lose to any team, I'll take the Rams.
You're like, okay, that's good. You can lose to my new home, not my old home, you know.
There you go.
I wanted to ask you, you know, being East Indian myself, you know, when I, like, I don't play Indian music. I'm not that type of musician. And it's like, I love Indian culture. I put a sitar in the intro of my last record as a way to kind of like show that's the roots of where I came from. But it's like, you know, kind of an onwards journey that you're trying to find identity with things. When it comes to comedy, or even, you know, when you're doing the talk show, do you find that you want to be inclusive with the culture? Do you kind of want to step away from it? Do you kind of use it as a muse? Do you incorporate that to your markets? Like, because I definitely separate myself from it, not intentionally, because I love Indian culture. I just don't want to be, you know, a Bollywood musician, you know, like that. I definitely know that that's not where I'm at, you know? So, you know, how do you use that for your art?
I think for me, it was always about addressing it close to the top. You know, that said, in every set, when you're in a room, the audience will notice what you give power to. So if you don't really talk much about being Indian and you really identify yourself as a short, bald man, and that's all you're going to lead with, that's pretty much what people are going to see. And they're going to kind of forget that you're Indian, especially if you're talking about everyday stuff. They're going through the same stuff. You're going through the same stuff. And stand-up comedy is a mirror or it's a window, right? It's either, hey, I'm one of you and I'm holding the mirror up to you and you can see yourself in me, or it's a window where, wow, we are so different. I'm not one of you. I'm one of them. And let me open the window, open the blinds, and you can look out the window into me, and this is how my people are. And I think it's great to show both sides of that so people feel like, oh, I learned a little bit about Indian culture. That said, wow, they're kind of like just like us. And you got to be careful with that because we're not just like you, but there are so much overlap. And I'm like you in that I'm super influenced by American culture, which you can see here. I mean, I have a big map of South Asia in the background there. But you see Castle Grayskull. You see, you know, Michael Jackson. You see a 76 sign, even though I was born in 76, so I'm attracted to that gas. But that said, you see this tribute to Americana. And even my parents say that. They're like, look, you are an all-American kid. You grew up here. We spoke English at home, and you took soccer lessons and swimming lessons with everyone else. And that said, I mean, I grew up where the mascot was the Fairfield Indians, and nobody even made that connection or joke until I was in 11th grade. Somebody's like, maybe you should be the mascot. And they weren't saying it mean. They're like, why don't you be the mascot? That would actually make a lot of sense. And it wasn't said with hate, but the fact that it took everyone, including me, 11 years even to make that connection tells you people were fairly colorblind, I think, in the 80s and early 90s.
Well, it's interesting because we probably have – we're both coconuts on that level. You know, like we're brown on the outside, we're white on the inside, and I think we kind of adapted to American culture maybe more so than Indian culture, because I remember when mm-hmm. you know, I went back to India as a kid, and I was like, it was like kind of like an identity crisis. I was like, I'm not like any of these kids because I mm-hmm. grew up in America. So it's like I see culture in a completely different way. But, you know, because I didn't really speak the language, I didn't really do any of those things, but I knew the food, I knew the music, I knew, like, the, you know, the big parts of the culture. But when it came to becoming an artist, I definitely didn't want to be known as the Indian musician, like, in the sense of, oh, I only do Indian music. Like, I actually went far away and went to, you know, Africa and wanted to do African music and incorporate a lot more of that in what I do. And it's kind of funny because, you know, the easy thing would be, oh my God, you got this huge market that is India. That's where you should find, you know, your market and kind of like, you know, market everything that you do towards that. Do you find that you resist that temptation, or do you just find that your art just doesn't identify with kind of maybe what's happening in that culture at that time?
It does. I mean, I think that it's so funny you said that about coconuts, like we're white on the inside. I'm so white on the inside, it's coming out of my ears. You can see it in the ear pod, so I'm fighting to keep it in there. So that said, look, I think that when people ask, well, who is your market, you know, you kind of go, well, it's me. It's people like me. So if you were born in this country or grew up mostly in this country and you're from India or you have an Indian background, that's going to be the sweet spot target, right? And those laughs are great, and we can commiserate or celebrate together in a way that no one else is quite going to get. And it's an inside joke and it's a litter joke in a way that no one else is going to totally get. That said, I think when I go to, you know, I've performed in small cities in India, and I performed in small cities in Alabama or Indiana, and getting those laughs, like from white folks who have had almost no exposure to people of color, or then Indian people who have had very little exposure, if any, to American culture, those laughs are particularly special. And a friend of mine asked me that, you know, he said, are those laughs worth more? I go, that's a good question. He goes, no, that's what you asked. And I go, well, I don't really remember asking that. He goes, I'm playing back something you said a long time ago. And I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm kind of smart, but also kind of stupid for forgetting my own question. He was just saying, hey, look, I'm a white guy in Ohio. I think you're hilarious. But we also have a shared background, like being growing up, you know, neighboring high schools, going to the same college. Anytime there's more and more overlap, you go, yeah, I should be able to make these people laugh because I am these people. When you go really far away from it and people look totally different, on one of the podcasts I'm doing, I had a middle-aged white nerdy guy with glasses, and then I had a younger black comic, pretty cool guy, Nirvana t-shirt, by the way, just like your Pearl Jam, so same era. Right. And it was great. I was making them laugh. They were getting along very well. You thought they were old friends. And that's what I love about America, though. You don't see that in many other parts of the world. Like, every country will have one, or many countries have one diversity. Like, France has Paris. You know, Spain has Barcelona, maybe Madrid. But the United States has like 15, 20 cities where you can see that. You can see blacks and whites and browns getting together and laughing at the same thing. That just doesn't happen anywhere else in the world.
Right. That's what makes America so great. Here's the million-dollar question. How did you break to your family that you wanted to be a stand-up comedian? Because, you know, in our culture, a lot of people don't really understand it, but in Indian culture, education is everything. And most Indians are doctors or engineers, and that's the path. And no matter what you want to do, that's the path that you should lead. And there are a few that break away from that. How did you break away from that, and how did your family take it?
You know, we're sort of an artistic family, not in that we're established in any major way, but my Masi, who just passed a couple of months ago, was a painter. She loved to sing. You know, my mom sang on University of Allahabad radio in India. My dad gives a Bollywood music and masala program every Saturday in Cincinnati. Shout out, Dad, WIAF 88.3, on the public access station there. And, you know, I have a brother who is, you know, a very good speaker, tennis player. The other kid, you know, the other brother is a very good singer and a very good artist and all these things. So it's sort of in the water. It's in the bones and the blood. And, you know, I think what most entertainers say to people is, look, if anything else would make you happy, do it. Like, don't go into this. Unless you really feel like you have to, don't. Right. Because it's very hard to succeed. And even the people who succeed fall into all sorts of traps, whether it's, you know, women, men, it's drugs, it's drinking, it's that total lack of structure. And I think, you know, white folks, black folks who listen to this go, hey, man, it's not like in our culture necessarily that our parents want us to become comedians either. And I'm like, I understand that. But the delta is so great because doctors are like 1 through 10. Like if you're a general practitioner, if you're an internal medic, you like failed. You should have been a cardiologist or a neurosurgeon. And then it's like maybe a dermatologist and maybe a pediatrician and then, you know, family practice. They still won. If you became a lawyer, you still lost. Like you still failed. It's just you could be at the top firm in the world. It's like, yeah, but you didn't really become a doctor. And then everything else under that, like an engineer is a great job, but yeah, but you didn't really become a lawyer. And so it's all the way down where you really get the sense of the delta being so great, of being on this path and being on this track of saying, I'm going to do this. And unless you do these things, I tell you, man, there's just not a culture that admires and places doctors on a pedestal, unless it's Jewish culture. I mean, we're very similar to Jewish culture in that way, that there's an old joke, and you could certainly appropriate it for Indians, but it's like there's the first Jewish president, and at the inauguration, his mother is sitting in the audience, and she nudges the person next to her and says, you know, his brother's a doctor.
That's awesome, too. Yeah, there is that. I don't know if it's a stigma or if it's just a stereotype or it's just like the pressure of just being an Indian American or just an Indian kid in general. But there's so many. I know you have the same. There's so many friends and cousins and people that went into medicine or engineering. Yeah. And they've led that path. And you're right. It's like this is not an easy world to go into. And I tell people that all the time. It's like, go into music if you absolutely know that this is everything that you want, or go into the arts for that. Because if you can make it a hobby, God, I wish I could make it a hobby, but there's no way I could make it a hobby. It is my life. It's all I think about. So I love that you have that kind of parallel, because everything's about just bringing joy with comedy. So let's go way back to Cincinnati. When was the first time that you knew that you wanted to be a comedian?
You know, it didn't really occur to me until I moved here. I moved here in 2006. I turned 30, flipped out that I'd been in Ohio my whole life. And shout out Ohio, great place. And I actually had someone on my podcast talk about how he loved Ohio. He goes, if I had to live inland to be Ohio, I'm like, wow, I'm so flattered. He goes, no, I think a lot of the cities there slept on, whatever. It's a great spot, but it's a big world. And to pick one state in one country and live there for what's probably going to turn into at least maybe a third of my life, or about a third of my life, that's a long time to spend somewhere, especially when you've traveled and there's just more to life than that. So I came out here. I was the brand manager of Fiji Water for 12 weeks.
Nice.
People ask if that was an internship. I'm like, no, it was a full-time job.
You're like, I was the brand manager and damn proud of it.
Yeah, it was a great job, but we went our separate ways amicably. And, you know, I spent a month meditating and writing out an analysis and figuring out, is this really what I want to do? Because it was a massive decision and I could have moved back to Cincinnati, but I got spiritual about it. And I thought, you know, I don't think God moves me 3 time zones to Los Angeles with a pretty good foothold, already being a feature comic, getting up, whatever, just to move back. That seems so lame. That seems just like, wow, why then? At least try and give yourself 2 years. And that's what I did. I gave myself 2 years and then it turned into 16.
That's amazing. You know, what's funny is for me, I went into music, but I was also pre-med in college. And, you know, you talk about like the wind talking to you. And I remember walking into my dorm and every roommate I had was a music major. And so when we went to music school, I was asking all the other music majors, oh, you guys all rooming with music majors? And they were like, no, I've got an architect major. I've got a film student. I've got a dentist student, you know. And like that's like the wind talking to you. So sometimes the spirit or whatever destiny is talking in your ear and telling you which way to go. A lot of people don't listen to that voice. And a lot of people in our culture definitely don't listen to that voice. So it's pretty amazing that you just kind of like took to it and kind of knew, okay, this is what I want to do. What was the moment of Zen that made you think, okay, I'm going to just jump in this full force and go headstrong into this one way or another, and just this is the life I'm going to live?
I think when it was the point where I got to the end of the 2 years and I had made a financial goal, because to me, being busy and just kind of going, there's got to be something tangible here, because you can love to do it, but I've got a very hard line when people talk about this is who I am, this is what I do. You know, otherwise say I'm an aspiring this, or I'm aiming to be that, or I dabble in that, you know, but to say that, hey, I'm an actor. Well, have you been in anything? Well, a couple student films, whatever. Hey, I'm not taking away from the fact that you feel like an actor, you act like an actor, and that may be your essence. But look, it's LA. Unless you're making $50,000 a year doing that, meaning that you could sustain yourself doing it, I don't think you can call yourself that. You know, you could say that I dabble in it, but look, I act, but I don't act enough roles. I don't book enough roles to say I'm an actor, because if that were all I did, I wouldn't survive. I'm a stand-up comic. That's what I do. I'm a talk show host because I'm able to put things out and get views and get guests and whatever. I don't get a lot of money being a talk show host, but I think people go, well, yeah, you clearly are, because you've got a show and you platform all these people and you are quite hosty. So it seems like you are that. But I always tell people, I think even when I wrote to you, I said, hey, it's an independent talk show. And I make sure that people know it's on YouTube. I'm not trying to pass it off like it's on NBC or whatever else. So I just think that kind of humility, you know, in this next generation, they just love to say that, hey, I'm an actor, I'm a comedian. It's, hey, that's cool, man. But you got to think of all the people who came before you and what we had to do to get to that point before we even dared call ourselves that. Because I'm looking around at Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle and Brian Regan and Jerry Seinfeld and all these guys going, they are comedians.
Right.
Like, I'm just trying to do this thing. And when I made a certain amount and hit my goal and actually exceeded my goal, it's like you're turning that into paychecks. You're turning that into money. People are paying to see you do it. It's not enough for you to just go, well, this is what I do and look at me. Yes, but are people looking at you? Are they paying ticket prices to come see you?
I'll tell you something that is a weird parallel. Mm-hmm. So, and I know that this doesn't happen in many other fields. So if I play a gig, this happens all the time. You know, I'll have a woman come up to me and say, oh, my husband's a musician. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, is he a musician or does he play music? Because those are two different things. Mm. Like, you know, I don't know anybody that would come up to a comedian and be like, oh, my husband's a comedian just because he's funny. But when somebody plays music, funny. They're a musician, and it's such an odd thing. And it's the first thing I think about. It's like, oh, I'll ask questions. Like, oh, does he gig around town? Does he play? Oh, no, he just plays at home. And immediately I'm like, your husband plays music. He's not a musician. A musician plays out, tours, records, makes records, is a part of some kind of movement, and is constantly out there performing, because that's what musicians do. So it's so weird. And I know that what you just said is exactly what, like, I scream that in my mind, because I take pride in being a musician. I take pride in doing the gigs. It's like a life's work. And you're the same way. You've been hustling comedy as long as I've known you, which has been about 14, maybe 12, 14 years, something like that.
I saw you at the House of Blues almost as soon as I got out here. I think I saw you in 07 or 08, might have been 06. You've been out here how long?
I grew up here. So I've been playing music since like 2003, 2002.
And then when did you become a musician?
Oh, well, I mean, I was really, that's when I really kind of tell people. It's like, July 25th, 2002 was the first gig my band ever did. That is the first official, like, I was doing acoustic sets before, but I feel like once I was in a band, okay, that's me being in a band. I'm really a musician. I'm really
so good. 20 years. Congratulations.
Yeah, 20 years, which is, I mean, it's been a grind, and it's, you know, it's taken me all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's random how the journey works, as you know, so like for you and we met you, I remember you emailed me and you said, you saw me at the House of Blues and you were doing a newsletter where you were interviewing Indian artists. And I was like, this guy's got such a novel approach. This is, and you, I think it was the Funny Indian. You were the Funny Indian, that like same as your handle. So, and I was like, this is awesome. And I just had so much respect because I know, you know, comedians especially, it is an amazing art form because you don't get rehearsals. Your rehearsal is your performance. And most people don't really understand how important that is and how crucial that is and how incredibly difficult that is, because I can rehearse a song in the privacy of a rehearsal studio and then go out and perform and know it's going to be somewhat all right. But you guys throw your art out there not knowing how it's going to be, you know, received. Tell me, is that part of the process for you as an artist super exciting and invigorating, or does it freak you out? Because it has to be a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I think you have to be willing to embrace that. I'm working on a new set right now about my son because he's 1 year old. You know, he's a 1 year old human being.
Congrats,
and I'm thank you. I'm doing this whole thing now where it's, you know, about, you know, what we went through. You know, obviously I wasn't pregnant, but, you know, having a pregnant wife and his coming into the world and all that. And so it's different. It's different material for me. But of course, when people know you're a father, they want to hear about that, right? They want to hear that growth. They want to hear, you know, especially in today's comedy where it's more personal. If you don't address that, it's almost like, I'm surprised you didn't really talk about that. Is that, you know, how is that going if you're not even willing to address it? So it, to me, you know, building that out, it's been interesting because you write a couple of jokes that you pretty much know are going to work because they made you laugh maybe out loud when you thought of it. So that's right. got to count for something. You're a comedian. You watch jokes all day. So if you wrote something that made yourself laugh or go, that's legitimately funny. You know, I mean, I wrote something where I go, you know, I open that hunk by saying, you know, he's a COVID baby. And the great thing about having a COVID baby is, you know, it's yours. And it's empirically funny. Like, it's going to get a lot. I knew when I wrote it, I'm like, that's a funny joke.
Right.
And I'm not really going to have to workshop it. So that gives me the confidence to go, okay, I'm getting that laugh. Let me time it in such a way and go for number 2, 3, and 4. Maybe you're not going to get that big of a laugh. If they do, great. But to your point about rehearsing, Nikki, you've got your inflection, which is going to completely change. If you're in a room by yourself, it's not a conversation. It's a monologue.
Right.
And it becomes a dialogue when there's someone else there.
Right.
And people are like, well, they're not talking. Like, they don't have to talk. As long as they're laughing and smiling, or even if they're sitting there in silence, it's still a reaction. It's still something. That silence, that nothing is something to you. And trust me, that silence can be really loud if it's not working. So you try to tent pole it a little bit where you go, okay, well, then you write another joke that you're pretty sure that's going to work too. And I think in the beginning, you can kind of fall back a little bit on either crowd work or stuff that's a little bit hackier that you probably know is going to work. So being Indian, you know, I can throw in a joke, something about how I was saying something like, we took a class online, it was COVID, so we had to do it on Zoom, and people are asking really stupid questions. And somebody asked, you know, since at UCLA, do they teach you how to parallel park? And it's like, no, it's not the DMV. It's a birthing class, right? So that joke might work, but then I know what's probably going to work is I go, well, then I asked, you know, we're Asian, so how early can we enroll him in SAT classes? Right? So you're probably that's going to work. It's a little bit hackier. You're Asian, whatever. Okay, got it. But you protect yourself from falling completely on your face because you've got a couple of jokes that you probably know are going to work, and then maybe you can pull those out. If you're like, okay, you know what? I don't need that. That was scaffolding. I'm building this building. Let's take the scaffolding away. Let the building shine. Let's really try to make that joke about parallel parking work, because to me, that's way funnier anyway. The fact that somebody asked that to me was just so stupid and so ridiculous. And I'm like, I want to make that work. And so you can slowly start peeling things away and go, okay, I'm gonna kind of unhack this set and try to make it as original as possible. But if you go out there and go, I'm going to just make this thing no matter what, some people have the balls to do that. But I also feel like you're sort of screwing the audience over too, especially if it's a paid crowd. You don't want to go out there and give them 10 minutes of garbage, you know.
Well, there's a famous clip in The Comedian. I know you know this movie.
Yeah. And yeah,
Orny Adams and Jerry Seinfeld, and Orny's like very confident. He's like, I think I'm gonna try some new stuff out on this, you know. And Seinfeld's like, I wouldn't do that. I don't know. And it didn't go over very well. And you just see Seinfeld like, yo, I tried telling you, like, don't try the new stuff. Go with your hits because you have this platform that it's not going to always deliver and be received in the same way as a comedy club. It's like, yeah. And it's also like, know the things that you can lean on in this opportunity. You know what I mean? So I think it was
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's all right. Go ahead. What were you saying?
The other night I performed here in Burbank, and there's a comic who got up on stage, and there's someone who actually came to see him and kind of gave him the third degree. She's a musician. I don't know her that well. I got to know her that night. It was pretty interesting, but she kind of gave him the third degree. She's like, I drove here to see you. You just kind of dicked around on stage. I was expecting a set,
you know?
And, you know, she's kind of ribbing him kind of gently, but kind of not, because she's a musician. And
right.
She's sort of like, hey, you know, I would have played a greatest hit of mine and then maybe done, hey, here's a new cut off for our new album, or cut off our new album, and then closed with a greatest hit or whatever it is. And that's kind of what you're supposed to do, create a you and kind of stuff the, you know, the new stuff in the middle, but still give me a show.
Right.
And if you're going to get up there and dick around, it's a little bit egotistical because you're like, well, this audience doesn't matter. Well, then do that at an open mic where that's what they're expecting. But this is a paid audience. They came to see a show.
Right.
And, you know, you do owe them a show. And I think some comics are like, I don't know, don't owe them anything. I'm like, no, you kind of do. Because they paid money to see a show, and you need to give them a show. And I think when I started off, I was like, why can't you just talk to the audience? Why does it have to be a performance? Because it's a performance. Right. If you want to watch people talk, you just go to a bar. But I want to see you put some oomph into it. I want you to sweat a little. I want you to work.
Yeah, it should take shape. Well, let's play something. What do you want to play us first of the clips you sent us?
I mean, the reason I sent you I Am Indian is because it's short and sweet, and it's the video for which I'm most known. So you can play it. And it was also India's Independence Day on Monday, so that's not
all right. That's right. That's right. Here's I Am Indian by Rajiv Satya.
I'm Indian. Just Indian. I'm not South Asian any more than Russians are North Asian. I'm not Asian Indian or East Indian. There are 1.3 billion of us. We don't need a cardinal direction, okay? It's not our fault that Christopher Columbus got lost. Sure, we love our states, but there's strength in numbers. One out of every six human beings is Indian. So stop dividing us. The British already did that once. And we need to quit saying that we're not Indian because I wasn't born here or sound like this or eat that. Our hearts are Indian. We are feelers. We gave the world the romance of Bollywood films and the music of Ravi Shankar and Zubin Mehta and Lata Mangeshkar and Asha Bhosle and the allure of the Kama Sutra. We are thinkers. We are great at math because we invented numbers. And we're pretty good at letters, too. We are doctors and engineers and techies. And we mean business. We are the world's third largest economy and the wealthiest ethnic group in America. We are huge and efficient. India is all on one time zone. That way everybody in the country is still late, but at the same time. We never invade anyone because we already have everything. Chess, the ruler, the button, wireless communication, arranged marriage, flush toilets, steel, democracy. All us, all India. And you are welcome, world, for yoga and elevating cricket into a multi-billion dollar sport and making food so good that you sailed across the planet to come have some. Our food is hot. Our country is hot. Our women are hot. Our men are lucky. Where the world prays, we meditate. We practically invented religious tolerance, and we gave you Mahatma Gandhi and pundits and gurus and karma and dharma and kismet and reincarnation. The motherland is magical and mystical, and no matter who you are, you can find yourself here in incredible India. Jai Hind! I am Indian! And I'm late. Told you I was Indian.
That's awesome. Dude, I've never seen that clip. This is crazy.
Oh, wow.
This is awesome. That was amazing. Tell me a little bit about the concept behind that, because you just jam-packed a whole bunch of amazing information, fun facts, and the pride of India in this little clip. It's just amazing. It's awesome.
Thanks, brother. I really appreciate that. I'm glad I was with you when you got to see it and experience it for the first time. Awesome. I put it out in 2014, and it makes the rounds every like Janmashtami or, you know, Republic Day or Independence Day. It goes around, which is great, and try to be inclusive and try to do everything I could in that video. But I tell you, you know, it takes a village. It takes a team. I remember my director at the time, the first cut of it, he just goes, is this a Wikipedia entry? Like, what is this? You're writing this completely from your head. I want you to go like to your heart. And then that's where I was like, okay, you know what? Let's go head, heart, soul. I'm going to write the first paragraph, head, second, heart, and then let's just really deep dive into the soul and just like, what is India really about? So that's what I attempted to do. It's not something I think that maybe one person could do it, maybe if you're Prince or something, but I think listening to the people around you and listening to my team helped bring that out of me. And it's funny because the director is Egyptian and the cinematographer is Mexican. It was great though. Like they were like, no, it's India. Give us India. Like reach in there and give it to me, man. We don't get it. Help us understand what is India. And
well, you gave it a historical lesson. You showed so many prophets, you know, like Mahatma Gandhi and musicians. And, you know, you showed this allure to the culture and how America is like, you know, like when you said the thing about yoga, it's like, yes, it's like America has completely embraced yoga and it is part of the culture, especially in Los Angeles, you know, in a big way. But
you know,
so it's kind of cool that you kind of give these shout outs in a way, but do it in a way that is identifying you with that culture. Was it important for you to make this message about you being Indian and also kind of educating people in such a quick, short little nugget of information?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's generally the macro why and the micro why, right? What's the global reason you're doing something and what's the personal reason you're doing it? And with all my projects, I try to look at it through those lenses of, you know, I'm working on this project now where, you know, we're looking at the top stand-up comedy specials in history, and we're getting input from some really great working comedians like George Lopez and Patton Oswalt and Russell Peters and Hasan Minhaj and Kathleen Madigan and, you know, just great, great names, Richard Lewis, and all these people are responding to us. And the reason I want to do it is I want to elevate the field of stand-up comedy. I think these stand-up specials are special, and I think they should be part of the zeitgeist, just like great movies and great albums. And Rolling Stone did a top 500 albums of all time. I'm sure you're aware of it. And then AFI did a top 100 films. So I go, let's do something similar for stand-up comedy. But my micro reason, my personal reason, is inadequacy and insecurity. I don't know this stuff, and I should know it. And I feel like, man, I don't really know what the greatest specials are. I haven't seen a lot of them. And just being kind of confessional and hosting it, not in a know-it-all way, and just watching it going, I get it. It's more like, hey, comedians, help me understand this. I want to be like, walk me through, be my Virgil, and, you know, walk me through this. And I want to go on a journey with the audience. So I think that's the same thing with the I Am Indian video, is this idea of like, I didn't know a lot about it. And there are times where you feel like, am I fully Indian? Well, your ethnicity is Indian, you know, but my nationality is American. And so am I able to make something like that and just pushing myself? And I think people from India are a little bit surprised, like, wow, a guy born in Ohio made that video. Right. I think that's kind of cool. To the point about resonating with people, like kind of our first point here about like, how can you resonate with people who are different from you, yet the same?
I don't know what it is about Indian culture. Maybe you feel this or maybe you don't. It's like Indian culture is, I mean, India, it is 1/6 of the world's population, right? And yet for some reason, instead of completely dominating the world economics in every field, it is really kind of, it doesn't have this following like it should. Like, I know you know what I'm talking about, because it's like, when you see it in other cultures, you see it in the African-American culture, you see it in the Jewish culture, you see it in Arabic cultures, you see it in Asian cultures, but I don't see it in the same way in Indian cultures. I don't know why it's like that, but there.
Why do you think it's like that?
I mean, I kind of feel like everybody's a little bit out for themselves in a way, whereas other cultures kind of think, hey, we need to kind of like show our greatest people and bond and get together and kind of like storm the castle together. But if for some reason, Indians are not like that. I don't find it like that, unless it's like something like Bollywood, or it's something like, you know, some other movie.
Cricket.
Yeah, it could be cricket. Yeah, it could be something where it's, you know, I find it strange. I find it very odd.
You know, it's interesting you say that, and it hadn't really occurred to me since when you were talking, I was thinking about it, which is, when people say that, I always think, so you weren't listening to what I was saying? It's like, no, I was inspired by what you were saying, because in this country specifically, you know, Jews have gone through the ringer everywhere, right? And then blacks in this country are just so downtrodden. We know the story. But I guess maybe it's because Indians came here, South Asians came here and just killed it from the jump, because we weren't really allowed, we were not legally allowed to come here till 1965. And then it's immigration of choice, not necessity. So the people coming here, people are like, oh, Indians are so smart. I'm like, no, you're taking the cream of the crop of any country and then putting them in the greatest incubator. Like, you're putting them in this oven of incubation where it's just like, you're taking the best ingredients and you're putting it in an oven where it's going to rise to the top like yeast. Of course it's going to, because you've got this high-end Bosch oven and then you've got this amazing top of the world ingredients. Of course it's going to taste incredible, right? So Indians are coming here doing their thing, and there may not be this like kumbaya, you know, need to band together, because it's like, we can do it on our own. We could forge our own path. And I certainly felt that way at Fairfield High School. I was a class president. There were 500 kids, you know, 480 were white, you know, maybe 10 to 15 black, 3 Latino, maybe 2 East Asian and 2 South Asian. That's pretty much it. And one of the South Asians is the class president in the early 90s. So I think we kind of look at that and go, you know, we did it. And it's almost like this Republican or conservative mentality. And I don't mean to make it political, but just this sort of like functionalist, like, hey, we did it, without sometimes remembering, well, we did it because our parents had an opportunity. They came here, it stood on the shoulders of giants, that kind of thing. But there wasn't this need for me to bond with Alok and Gaurav and Ashish and get through this. It was more like, oh, what did you get on your SATs?
Right.
And what school did you get into? And not to one-up each other, but it was almost this friendly competition because you see everybody else doing so well and you want to also. And that's occurring to me now that we didn't have this shared misery in this country.
Well, I also think it's like, you know, like Russell Peters now, because he's become successful, he can tour India, whereas he couldn't even when he was getting success. Like there's a sense of until you get, you know, you open up the reason for India to back you and you, you know, you kind of pay your dues, then India will kind of embrace you. Whereas in a lot of other cultures, it's not like that. It's like there's a lot of like, let's bring these artists or these speakers or these candidates or whatever it is to the forefront because we can get behind them. That's what I find is a little strange. It's like if you toured India, I don't know what the market would be. And I know for myself, like I have a bigger market here than I ever would in India. But the fact that I have a market here and I have no market there is ridiculous. I think it's completely ridiculous. But I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, if I was a cricket player there and I came over here to expect that same, you know, kind of like notoriety. No, I understand that. But what I'm saying is I'm representing the culture. You're representing the culture in a melting pot of a lot of different cultures and succeeding. And, you know, a country that is trying to get a foothold could embrace that a little bit more. And I find that the culture doesn't really do that because they're waiting for you to get ginormous amounts of success. And then they'll call because they want their nephews or their, you know, their cousins to know, you know, to have you do a phone call with them to try and
get
them in the industry. You know exactly, because I know you've probably done it like I've done it, you know?
So 100%. 100%. I think that is true. And, I, you know, in comedy in India, I performed in 11 states there, so kind of all over the country. And, you know, for me, I have a theory, or at least my experience has led me to believe that it goes back to the one of them, one of us thing, right? And so if it's somebody who's from India, it's very much one of us and they're cracking local jokes and all that stuff, not to say they're not good or bad or it's not a value judgment. Then the other end of the spectrum is a white guy or a black guy or a Latino guy, right? But being Indian American or an NRI, a non-resident Indian, for those of us who don't know that, or just being from Britain or Fiji or South Africa or whatever else, you are a half step away, right? You know music, obviously, a whole note and a half, you know, a whole note and a half note and a whole step and a half step. And you're just kind of like, you are them, but you're not. And they sometimes can't get past the fact that you look like them, but you kind of don't. And then you don't sound like them at all.
Right.
And yet you know a lot about where they live and your parents were here and now they're not. It's just a lot for them to kind of process. And I'm not knocking the crowd. I'm just saying that is a lot to process. That's a lot of layers. And so you're either one of them, you're Gabriel Iglesias, or you're, you know, somebody Biswa, you know, who's from there. And I think that's the whole idea is like, it's one end of the spectrum or not, or the other, but if you're caught in the middle, they're not totally sure how to receive you, to your point, unless you achieve a massive amount of fame.
That's crazy because in other cultures, you don't have to get that gold medal to have the stamp of approval for it, for the whole country to get behind you. Whereas in Indian culture, they're like, let's see what you've done and wait, you know, because I've also performed in India and it's like the response was amazing. It was awesome. And, you know, I was thinking I could do this more all over, but there's also not the same kind of platform to do that over there like there is here. So it financially doesn't make a lot of sense until you're able to pack a cricket stadium with people. So it's like, I feel like, you know, I can only tell another Indian artist this, because it's a gripe that I'm like, man, the amount of success, if we all kind of banded together and did tours together or did more things where it's like you're collaborating together. Mm-hmm. I mean, the amount of exposure. I mean, you know, like a perfect example is System of a Down. System of a Down, they made their break because their entire market was all Armenian fans. They used to pack every club all over LA with Armenian fans. And because of that, that's why they got the record label. That's why they got everything they got. And they still have this Armenian following. But even Russell Peters, he has a little bit of an Indian following, but it's like the cool thing about Russell Peters is he has like this eclectic mix. Do you find when you're kind of targeting the audience, do you want a little bit more of your culture represented, or do you want to see every culture represented?
I think it's ideal to have more of your own culture there, because then it shows the support, right? It's like having a restaurant. You know, you go into a Mexican restaurant, Indian restaurant, you hope to see Mexican people there. You hope to see Indian people there. Otherwise, the restaurant probably isn't that authentic. But that said, you want other people there too, because you want the secret to be out, and therefore it's reaching outside. It isn't just a bunch of brown people there. They're like, oh, white people are coming, black people are coming. They're coming to traveling this side of town or this pocket that we know just to come have our food, which is awesome. So I think it's both. I think what's interesting about that is Russell has this pan base. That said, 80% of his base when you go to a show is brown, right? And what's odd, though, is it's the same thing with Hasan Minhaj. You know, Hasan is massive and probably the hottest South Asian comic in the country and has been for a while. Still, you go to a show, 70, 80% brown. And that's interesting because he's really mainstream. I mean, people know who he is. People who follow comedy know who he is. Yet when you go to a show, it's still – but it's, again, because he has achieved that success. Right. He's so big that now Indians are coming in going, oh, even the Hindus will watch a Muslim, right? They're like, oh, let's, he's our guy. It's like, I don't know if they'd be saying he's our guy if he were bobbing up there, right? But now that he's doing great, so yeah, he's Indian.
We can get behind him. Well, let's play another clip. What do you want to play next?
What did I send you? I sent you...
You sent me the talk show host clip, which we'll play at the end. And then I can tell you the...
Because I sent you a long one from YouTube. Can you play something from Instagram or no?
What did you send? Let me see what you sent. Hold on.
Let me actually, you know what I'll do is I'll resend you something. Why don't we play the doctor's clip? And then in the meantime, I'll send you the third clip, and that will be on YouTube. And that should be a good one for you to play too.
Okay, cool. I will, let's do the doctor's clip. Here's Doctor by Rajiv Satya.
Great. Any doctors here tonight? Any doctors? Yeah. What kind of doctor are you, sir?
Surgeon.
You're a surgeon. Wow. That's serious. That is serious. What do you surge?
You don't
want to
know.
I don't know. I do want to know. I apparently can't ask questions here tonight. That's great. So, are you working? Should I start there? That's not a good. I should use the exact same question. Would we have seen you in anything? Okay. We would have seen you in someone, actually. That is possible. It is surgery. Not that way, or it'd be sexual harassment. But you know what I mean. The person is asleep. Are you Bill Cosby? That wasn't the question. That's not where I was going with that. All right. Very nice. Very good. Bill Cosby joke. Gotta laugh. This is good. You guys are a good crowd. All right. Hitler, Bill Cosby can do no wrong up here tonight. This is good. Okay. These guys are loose. I like it. Okay. So what do you?
I'm a microsurgeon.
A microsurgeon. So surgery on guys my height and smaller. Exactly. Like basically 5'6", there's a tinier. Because it's like operation. You have to really kind of be, the guy's really big like the dude back there, but 2 1/4. You need a macro surgeon, really. Right. I got it. Okay, good. I'm getting there. You know, the set picks up. I'd like to start slow, and I like to pick it up. All right, cool. Very cool. He operates on penises? Microsurgeon. So in this case, especially a microsurgeon. Absolutely true. It's really, yeah.
Remember when I said my wife was always right?
Yeah, that's it. You even make the operation sound. That was true. I see that. I see that. I like that. Okay. I went to school to be a doctor because, I mean, obviously, you know. And I was pre-med. I was pre-med for a couple of years. And now I'm post-med. I just skip the med part. Really, that's where the work is. You know,
come to my office.
I will come to your office. I will come there because I want to see what a doctor does. See, when we can see you're an actor, we can see your work. We can watch Parenthood and determine whether you're a good actor, right? We could go, oh yeah, you know, pretty good. But with you, I don't know what a doctor's job is. I don't get the job. I don't get it. Because I go there, I go to a doctor's office, and then the nurse comes out, and she does, or he does, basically 90% of the job, right? It's a lot of it. Take your temperature, weight, vital signs, make sure you're alive, give you the cheat sheet. Honestly, the nurse has done a lot of the work. It's crazy. Do we have any nurses here tonight? No Filipinos? Okay, so nothing like that, right? It's true. There are a lot of nurses. I'm glad, though. No groans. That's good. We're past groans. It's not bad to be a nurse. But it's odd that they're nurses and they're registered nurses. That's an odd thing, that they're the only people who are registered. Well, sex offenders and them, basically. It's really, I don't know if it's the same registry. I don't know what's really going on with that, to be honest. But then you come in, the doctor comes in. But I've never had a more than a two-minute appointment, lots of things in my life are that way, but more than a two-minute appointment with a doctor. And doctors keep leaving the room. I've never had a doctor sit down, right? They keep leaving the room. At least once, if not twice, a doctor leaves that little room. I don't know, where are you going? Bathroom. You can't hold it.
A lot of iced teas at lunch.
I guess so. I just don't understand that. I don't know if you're looking up stuff on WebMD or you're Googling it. I think you are. I think you don't know the answer. Really, I can't do that here. I can't go, wait a second, and then run out and, oh, that's the joke. I have to come up with it now. I can't. It's odd. And then you headline. You do surgery. That's your headlining. That's your big gig. And then you knock us out for that. We can't even see you surge. We cannot see you do surgery. That's going to be, I'm telling you, that's going to be on ChapChat. It's ChapChat. I get Snapchat, whatever it is. Too old. I can't even figure it out. I can't even say it like that. But that's, we don't even see you do that. You don't even knock us out. An anesthesiologist does that work. You don't even do that. And then we come to, and then we need medicine, and a pharmacist gives us the pills. What do you do? You guys are event planners, really. You're general contractors. That's the job. I don't know what the job, I should have been a doctor. I don't get it. I do not get the job. It's an odd job.
That's awesome. It's so true too, because every doctor appointment I've been to, they're not around when you need them. You know, that's like they're not doing the hardcore work. They're just coming in. They're like, we look at the stats, and this is what it is. It's funny.
Nothing but love for doctors, man. You know, that's the thing, is you can make fun of them because they're doing so well. You're not ripping on people who don't have money. It's like a lot of time doctors are the best audience because they're like, just tell your jokes. But like they're making $1 million a year. What do they care if you make fun of them?
Well, I want to play your clip of the talk show, and we'll talk a little bit afterwards. But let's play this clip of your talk show. This is season 2 that you sent me?
I think so. If it's I just emailed you a new clip, which would be the trailer for season 2. But play whatever, and then we'll take it from there. But it is a talk show. What do you bring to the table?
All right, here it is. What do you bring to the table? By Rajiv.
There we go. Hey, man.
Oh, my gosh. Hey.
Good.
It's so funny. I have the same thing in my garage, too.
This is exactly the response we were going for.
Oh, my gosh.
You nailed it. You nailed it. Oh, my gosh. Oh, this is am I home?
This is so great.
Thanks, man.
I love it. It's like, I mean, there's so many photos of you, which is all I could ever ask
that's
for.
That's the focus.
Yeah, yeah. Funny. But seriously, I have the same thing in my house.
That's what I heard. Everyone's like, you and Connor have to meet. Because he's got a shrine to you.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't? I know, that's great. We have that in common already. We're off to the races. So would you like to come sit at our booth?
I would be so honored.
Okay, let's do exactly that.
You always got to have a little bit of disappointment in there. You know, got to give him a little bit of disappointment. Yeah. That's what I did. I was like, I'm going to choose the most unstable career path that you can think of. And then I'm going to pursue that for the rest of my life so you guys can never fall asleep sound.
And you are, right? I mean, we were saying this, this is half your life. You are making that transition from
you're far from a child now, but from child to adolescent to adult acting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's funny is you spend so much of your 20s, as I'm making this transition out of like being a child actor, I'm just making a transition to being a teen actor.
Right.
Because there's so many 20-year-olds that play teenagers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so funny. You look at Euphoria, for example, and very talented cast.
Sure.
But also a lot of them in their mid-20s.
Yeah.
Playing 18-year-olds, 17-year-olds.
It's true.
Which is very funny.
And that's true. All the way back to 90210 and stuff in the 80s and 90s, it was that way. They were, a lot of them are mid to later 20s, and they're playing in high school. And you're going, wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
They did it back then, they still do it now.
Yeah.
I'm sure, so it makes the kids feel good about losing those jobs.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now, I heard in one of your interviews you said acting's hard. It doesn't come easy to you. It's hard. It's a challenge.
Yes.
Is that still true?
Yeah. I think it's always been one of those skills. I'm going to, like, repeat myself here, but, like, that doesn't come naturally to me. It's one that I've had to, like, dedicate a lot of time and classes to, and I like it that way because I never feel satisfied, and that makes me want to, like, keep working and keep doing things. Because I think the moment that I feel like, oh, I've conquered this skill is the moment that my career dies for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as an actor, you should never stop learning. Like, your craft is ever evolving.
Sure, sure. And do you feel like you summon that talent at will? You're able to just turn it on? Or is it, you feel like if you've prepped and you've prepped and you've prepped and you're ready, or how do you feel like, okay?
Yeah.
Especially during COVID when you're saying it's hard to...
Yeah, it's a mix. I think there's the frustrating thing about acting is it's art at the end of the day. So it's creativity is going to be there some days, and it's not other days.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some days I show up on set and it's butter. It's great. Everything is moving smoothly, and I'm like nailing all of these scenes. I don't feel anxious. And then there's other days where, you know, there'll just be a back and forth of like, you're going to the director, you're like, this doesn't feel right, and they're like, yeah, I know, something isn't working, and it's like a puzzle, you're just trying to figure it out. And those days can be frustrating, but I try to make them, I try to readjust it to feel more rewarding because I'm trying to figure it out.
Are you ever off, or you're going, you know, I'm not feeling, but the director's like, no, that's great, or vice versa?
All the time.
Which would you rather? Where you don't feel it, or what? I mean, or you're like, gosh.
I think I'm always going to feel that way. I think I'm always going to feel unsatisfied with my work.
Mm-hmm.
my friend, Julia Hart, who I worked with on Stargirl, she directed it.
Mm.
And what was really challenging was my scenes were like really sporadically, they were sporadic throughout the shoot.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like come in for like a day or two, and then I would have like 2 weeks off. And so, like, I came in one day for the tail end of the day, and it just felt off. I felt like I was having a horrible day. And I went to her, and I was just like, Julia, if you need to reshoot this day, like, I will come back for free.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Like, whatever you need to do, like, I'm so sorry. And she was like, I have no idea what you're talking about, but thank you.
That's unusual, isn't it, to offer that up?
And I mean, I...
And your agent was probably going, 10% of zero.
10%, yeah.
Well, no, that's funny. Like, when I first started doing stand-up, I remember I was doing a gig on the East Coast, and then somebody told me that he drove 100 miles to come see my show.
Wow.
And I know my show went really well, but I go, so do you guys want to go do something after this? Like, I just blurted it out. And he goes, well, I mean, that was a show, though, right? But I felt so insecure because I go, I'm funny. I'm not, like, a 200-mile round-trip funny.
Yeah.
I feel like I need to, like, take you out for a drink now and make up for that.
100%.
So that's normal.
Yeah.
Or we're equally abnormal.
Yeah. Or we both just have anxiety disorders.
Awesome, awesome. I love this concept. I love that you're doing it. And this year, you kind of like redid your garage to make it a set, as I assume, or was your garage always looking like this?
You know, yeah, I woke up like this, wake up Hollywood. So for me, it was built with this in mind, right? And so we built this from the ground up. There was an old garage here and it was really run down. And I thought, you know what, let's knock the whole thing down. Let's start over, because it's never going to be exactly what you want if you're trying to remake something old into something new. Let's just go ahead and go from the ground up. So very fortunate, man, very blessed, very lucky to be able to do this. I'm very When I say this, I mean, even this career, this life, everything I get to do, get to talk to you tonight, Nikki, everything. But, you know, specifically with the talk show, people can find it at watchrajiv.com or just go to my Instagram.com/funnyindian and check it out there, because the clips are doing really great. Like the YouTube videos, they do all right. They're longer. People don't have the attention span. But the clips, I think we just passed 1.2 million, about 1.2 million.
Congrats.
So that's great. Thanks. And I got to give a shout out to the community. I know we talked about it can be a challenge sometimes, but people have come together to watch these clips. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in there. And that's not because of me, maybe partly, but the guests have really been open and vulnerable and have shared their stories, which is awesome.
Well, Rajiv, you've been a wonderful guest, as always, on Wake Up Hollywood. I want to continue this conversation. And you know what? We wish you nothing but the best. And I want to see more Rajiv. We want to see more things happening, like you're just always hustling. And we appreciate you so much.
Thank you, Nikki. Thanks for having me. I appreciate you and your persistence in doing it, because I know we've known each other a long time. And let's catch up personally as well sometime soon.
Absolutely. Let's do it. On behalf of Sam, myself, Rajiv, take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. Peace and love, everybody. Thanks, Rajiv. We wish you nothing but the best. All right, guys, be good. Signing off for now. We'll see you guys next week.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.